The BMI scale. I feel like I talk about that all the time. The B, like, what's a healthy weight? You know, what maybe challenging why weight is not a good thing to base our health off of. Like, I feel like that is like people are like mind blown because their whole life they're kind of taught that that's the core marking of if someone is healthy or not.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to today's show. Hey, you know, when it comes to eating disorders, I know there's still so many people out there that think it's quote unquote just about food, weight, or willpower, when in reality, there's often a whole lot more going on underneath. And for those of you listening, you probably know that. Anxiety, perfectionism, rigidity, obsessive thinking, body checking, reassurance seeking, all of those pieces can get tangled up in ways that make recovery feel confusing, exhausting, and honestly, really hard to untangle on your own. And maybe some of you listening can relate to some of those things. And in this episode, I'm joined by Dana Kohlhart, who is a psychotherapist who specializes in OCD, anxiety, phobias, and eating disorders. And we're talking about the overlap that so many people miss. We get into how OCD and eating disorders can feed off each other, why your brain can start labeling food and body changes as danger, and how exposure work can help you slowly take your life back. So, if you've ever felt trapped in rituals, rules, checking, or the constant mental noise around food in your body, I really hope that you find today's episode helpful. So let me know after you listen. I always, always love hearing from you. So with that, all that being said, I'm going to go get our guest and get into it. All right. Well, Dana, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm super excited to get started with you today. But first, I always like to ask guests if they're okay with it, if they could share a little bit about like how you got started in your career and maybe just something, you know, if you're okay with it, starting a little bit about your personal journey with all this.
Of course. So years ago, about 10 years ago, I started as a therapist, and I noticed a lot of people with general anxiety disorder were getting misdiagnosed with OCD. So people were not getting the right treatment for the disorder that they had. The OCD world kind of gradually put me into the eating disorder world because there's so much overlap with OCD and eating disorders. And I just very naturally fell into the eating disorder world as well. I think it spoke to me really on like a deep level, just being, you know, a woman in society. You know, I'm sure obviously men relate as well, but just the pressures of diet culture. And I love the idea of intuitive eating and, you know, no bad foods, and just having like it just resonated with me so much to have this healthy relationship. I was like, I've never heard this before. Like, people are actually talking about having like a real healthy relationship with food. So then I explored my SED certification and just got like deeper and deeper into the community, the eating disorder community. And I just really love the work. I think it's really great to see, you know, people get better and kind of heal their relationship with food. And that's my journey so far.
Okay. And, you know, people might not, and I have the SED certification too. So just for people who don't know, it's the Certified Eating Disorder Specialist certification, which, you know, I think sometimes I brought it up on the podcast before, but why was it important for you think, to get the specialization and work with eating disorders and anxiety and OCD?
Yeah, so I'm definitely, the way I learn is through supervision. So I ended up with a supervisor, even after I became a fully licensed therapist, I ended up with a supervisor. I don't know, for your listeners who don't know, when you become a therapist, you have to have a supervisor to get your hours, and it's part of the process of becoming a therapist. And even after I could kind of practice on my own, I just learned through supervision rather than listening to someone kind of like talk at me in like a training. I just don't learn well that way. So I wanted to learn more about eating disorders and treatment because I was seeing it a lot in group practice. And so I hired a supervisor. I got a supervisor for myself who had her SED certification, and she kind of told me about the process. And I was, yeah, I just felt like it was so important to really know all the angles and treatment. And I love the SED certification too. I feel like it goes so much into the medical side because it's really for like the dietitians, medical doctors, nurses, therapists. So you really see like the whole picture of eating disorders, and it just makes me feel a lot more confident in my work as well. I feel like as a newer clinician, I was kind of overwhelmed. Like, you know, I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing, and this can be really complex, and I don't want to cause anyone harm. So I just really wanted to make sure I had quality training. And then part of the SED certification is that supervision piece. So that also drew me to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I think, you know, it's so important too. And so as we're talking today, I'm curious for you, where did you see the overlap between like anxiety, OCD, and eating disorders? Like, where did you start to see all of that kind of together?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So very early on in my career, I started making this connection between the two. You know, I think people that have OCD tend to be more perfectionist, have a lot of rigidity, a lot of black and white thinking, which is kind of like the perfect storm for an eating disorder a lot of the time. I think also too, a lot of the time what I see happens is that people develop eating disorder behaviors to kind of manage the OCD symptoms. Like, they're in a lot of distress from their OCD and they don't know how to manage it. And then they already kind of have this predisposition to rigidity or, like black and white thinking, like I had said. And then the eating disorder behavior kind of soothes their emotions. And they're like, oh, I found something that kind of helps. And then it kind of goes from there.
So for anyone who's listening is like, I'm wondering, like, you know, maybe I'm a perfectionist, or, you know, maybe these are things that I might be doing. Like, what are some of the specific things that you're seeing that maybe someone can identify with?
For OCD. So, and you're asking for OCD specifically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So with OCD, we usually see intrusive thoughts. So thoughts about, what if something goes really wrong? What if I lose my job? What if I accidentally hit someone when I was driving? What if I accidentally, this is a food related one, what if I accidentally forgot to check the allergy label on back of the nutrition packet, and I'm going to have an allergic reaction, or my kid's going to have one? You know, we all have those thoughts. Like, everyone kind of has those thoughts. But with OCD, I always explain it like the alarm system is overactivated. So most people are able to just be like, I probably checked it, no problem. And they kind of move on. Whereas when you have OCD, your brain gets stuck and it sees that thought as very important. And you start doing compulsions to feel better about the thought and the anxiety that's coming up. So you might keep checking the package and be like, you know, keep reading, like, okay, it's peanuts there, peanuts there. Or you might keep on circling back around the block if you thought maybe you hit someone. Or I see this one a lot too, like social situations, worrying you said something to offend someone. Again, we've all had those moments where like we're like, I hope I didn't say anything last night that was embarrassing, or I met these new people. We all have those thoughts, but with someone with OCD, instead of being like, who knows? I don't know. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. Like, I guess we're going to have to move on. Their brain overestimates the danger of that thought, one, and then two, it latches onto that thought, and then they do compulsions. They might check, like, is my friend mad at me? Let me text them, like, and covertly kind of see, like, if they respond or not. Or maybe they start asking them, like, did I say anything wrong last night? So also, you see a lot of reassurance seeking. So people might ask, like, are you mad at me? Are you sure it's okay I ate that? You know, just questions. Like, they really can't kind of tolerate uncertainty. So there's a lot of, like, I almost call it like a scientist mode. They're always like trying to get to the bottom of something. Lots of Googling, lots of Reddit, lots. Now the big thing is ChatGPT. So now talking to ChatGPT all the time.
Yeah, it sounds like it takes up a lot of mental space and a lot of emotional time and a lot of time just in general. A lot of focus away from other things.
Yeah, yeah.
Like spinning.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, depending on if it's mild, moderate, severe, it could, you know, it could take up a few hours a day versus, you know, someone else more on the moderate might take up five. And in really severe, more severe cases, you might take up like the whole day. Like, you're kind of fixated trying to figure out, you know, am I going to get sick from eating this food or not? Maybe someone's afraid of food poisoning. And so, you know, instead of just kind of sitting with that fear, they'll probably go into, like I was talking about, that scientist mode. Like, they're going to go into figuring out, like, all right, is there any news articles that show signs that I could get food poisoning? Like, maybe they start taking their temperature, they start like checking their stomach. And so they really go into, and then it would go all day, like checking and kind of ruminating and trying to make that alarm go off.
So, like, specifically with someone who's struggling with like body image, eating disorders, you know, as you're talking, I'm just thinking like, okay, you know, I've talked to my patients about this too, like constantly checking like the scale or lifting their shirt up, like body checking and different kind, there's different kinds of ways to body check. And then like, there's that moment of reassurance, but it's fleeting. And then they keep needing to do it over and over and over, or like mental math with the calories, like, you know. And I'm wondering for you, like, what are some ways that someone would know they're kind of doing this with their eating disorder behaviors?
Like excessive, like checking behaviors. Yeah. So I would look for an anxiety decrease. Like, I think that, so with OCD, the compulsions cause a decrease in anxiety temporarily, which I think we could definitely go into that temporary reduction and why it's not really good in the long term. But I think if someone notices, like, right before they step on the scale, they have a lot of anxiety, and then after, like, they feel a little bit better. Or we know, you and I, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners too, we know it doesn't really last, but if they're seeing that kind of temporary relief, and then maybe it lasts for 10 minutes and then they have to jump back on, or they, because then they probably have another thought, like, well, what if it was wrong? Or what if I ate something? What if it, you know, and then you start like looping, and then you have to get back on it. Yeah. So I think that's a scale example. I think, you know, people can get very compulsive with calories, tracking, steps, things like that, exercise. I think I would also look for, if they can't do the behavior, how much distress that causes them as well. We look for that a lot with OCD. Like, if that's part of our assessment, if we're assessing someone, if they can't do the behavior, so if they can't weigh themselves, if they can't count, if they can't eat certain foods that they feel safe with, like, how much distress is that going to cause them? And then if someone said like a lot, I would, obviously that would be, you know, something we need to work on.
Right. And, you know, what's your experience with people when they are following all of these rules and regimens and all the things, and then the outcome they're hoping for, something goes awry and it's like, wait, I'm following all my rules and my rituals and the scale doesn't show me what I want it to, and I don't get that relief.
Yeah, I think so. Some of the things that happen to the brain when we're doing that is basically we're kind of teaching our brain, to be afraid of certain things, right? Mm-hmm. So like when we avoid certain foods and we have all these rules, like you're talking about, like we have to eat this, we don't have to eat this, we have to exercise, whatever everyone's rules are, the more they do them, the more that teaches their brain that by adhering to those rules, we're safe. Mm-hmm. And then they become more and more afraid of not doing the rules. And then their world becomes smaller and smaller. Biologically, the body starts to fight back, right? Like, you know, our brains start giving us signals that we're hungry. And so now you're ruminating about food more. And, it just never seems to be enough for the eating disorder. And I think, so not only is it never enough for the eating disorder, I also think it just creates a fear map that's not really accurate for people, right? Like if, you know, we all know that eating a certain food is safe, right? But then the more you avoid it, you teach the brain that that food is dangerous. And now your brain is like certain that that food is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And you can talk to your therapist, you could talk to your dietitian, and they'll all tell you that food isn't dangerous, but you've avoided the food so much that your brain is convinced that it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you do, like, first steps with someone in your office if they're like, say there's a food in their mind, they're like, nope, I can't eat that, that's dangerous, and oh, I have to exercise X amount of minutes every day, and it has to be this type of exercise, or, you know, they go into a spiral in their mind of like something bad's gonna happen. Like what kinds of things do you start doing to help people realize, A, they're doing that, because they might not even be aware that mm-hmm. this is something that they're struggling with. They may just think, no, I have to do these things. How do you help somebody?
Yeah. So I think, you know, most people that do reach out for therapy, like there is somewhere in them, like some motivation, they want to change something. Like they might not be willing to change all their behaviors, but there is a part of them that's like, I've been doing this for so long and it's not working for me anymore. Like, I don't feel comfortable. I kind of need help. So I always try to kind of start there. And then I definitely do a lot of psychoeducation, like why dieting doesn't work, why these cycles don't work. Like, I think there's just so much misinformation about exercise and diet culture, and even from people's medical doctors, like kind of telling them you only need X amount of nutrition a day and you should do this. So I feel like undoing that is a large part of the beginning steps of therapy, and just kind of maybe introducing intuitive eating or just like alternative, you know, things that the alternative ways of being that they've never even probably heard of before. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I would probably start to ask, like, can we make a list of good foods, like safe foods and fear foods, or things that you have to do to, that make you feel safe, that maybe you want to get rid of, but you feel like you don't know how to. Because I don't know if you find that with a lot of your clients as well. I think, you know, people feel like they want to stop the behaviors a lot of the times, but they feel like they can't, or they don't know how to take those first steps.
Right.
Yeah. So kind of coming up with a plan of, okay, your eating disorder has labeled this and this as kind of like safe, and this and this as unsafe, and you want to do the unsafe things, but you don't know how to. So, you know, let's make a plan together and we can kind of gradually come up with exposures and homework, and maybe in session you can bring in a food and we'll do it together. And that's kind of how I work it with them in terms of the exposures.
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? Well, for a few things you said, like the psychoeducation first, I think people are like mind blown. It's almost like all the things are like, it's, yep. Oh, this is common knowledge. This is what everybody thinks. And then it's like, it's almost like, yeah, it turns everything on their head. Like, wait, people look at me like I have 10 heads sometimes. They're like, what are you talking about?
Like, they've never heard it before. They're like, what do you mean? Like, that food's not bad, or that I don't need to do. Like, it's completely like alien. Like, they're like, what is this thing that you're telling me about?
And people listening might be like, what on earth are you talking about? Like, what are some of the things that people go, what? And so, I mean, maybe we should talk about just a few of those things, because I think, you know, there is a lot of misinformation and it just makes my head spin just hearing it. But yeah, like there's just some basic things. Like, I'm just curious the things. I'm sure they're the same, but I'm curious what you tell people.
Like the BMI scale. I feel like I talk about that all the time. What's a healthy weight? You know, what maybe challenging why weight is not a good thing to base our health off of. Like, I feel like that is like, people are like mind blown because their whole life they're kind of taught that that's the core marking of if someone is healthy or not. And, you know, so BMI, what is healthy eating? You know, I think there's, again, there's just so much diet culture about like, what's healthy versus what's not healthy. I feel like one of my ways that really resonates with people, if I usually go into diet trends and I kind of tell them like, you know, it was like this in the 90s and this in the 2000s, and now we're doing this. They're like, oh, wow, that's totally contradictory. None of that makes sense. And I'm like, yes. Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything else. I'm sure exercise recommendations. I'm curious if you have anything that you would add to that you feel like people are totally, I mean, intuitive eating, I feel like most people have never heard of.
Or if they have, they think it's another diet, which is interesting because in the media it gets really written up that way almost. It's like the intuitive eating diet, or what did I say, like intuitive fast, intermittent fasting. It's like so bastardized. It's like the concept is not even right. But yeah, it's funny because I go through all the diets too, right? I say like, oh gosh, you know, I'm like a product of the 80s, like carbs were king. And like, you know, now I'm like, everyone hates carbs. It's like, it's just, I'm always waiting for like the next diet to come to get its 15 minutes of fame that's going to contradict the one that's popular right now. It's like, what's next? To your point. And just even, you know, I brought it up on here several times, like, you know, the Ansel Keys study of like the starvation study and how many, I'm not going to talk calories on here, but if you want to go check it out, go check it out. How many calories they considered inhumane for starvation is now considered like even more than most people think is the norm. And, you know, why diets don't work. And yeah, to your point, the BMI is this like ancient statistic that was based on nothing, and somehow it became like the standard for health. And there's such a rich history there that is mind boggling. All the things you're talking about, and how exercise and eating got connected is a whole nother thing, because to me that's just purging.
So usually those are my first, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 sessions with people, just lots of education, kind of how I approach. I'm very honest, like these are my views in terms of like food and weight, and definitely take a health at every size approach. So I'll definitely explain all of that. And then, I usually will ask someone like, where would you want to be at the end of this? Like at the end of treatment, like, do you want to be able to eat freely? Do you not want to obsess over your weight anymore? Do you want to get rid of the scale? Like, do you want to stop thinking about food? Like, and kind of gauge what their end goals are. And then, you know, I can work backwards and explain like, okay, this is how to stop thinking about food all the time. Not that it's not that there's anything wrong with that, because food is lovely and it's something to enjoy. But, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure you see as well, kind of coming in under eating and not adequately getting enough food. And so their brain is sending them messages all day to eat. So that's why they're thinking about food. And they've never heard anything like that. And again, it's another one of these, oh, really? That's why I'm thinking about food all day. Like, they're thinking that they're, I don't know. I don't know if you hear this a lot too, but they're usually thinking that they're kind of like emotionally thinking about food, when it's usually like very biological reason why you're thinking about food.
Mm-hmm. Or there's just a malnourishment in general, like not eating enough.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The body's going to like fixate on what you're not getting to stay alive. So of course.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, you know, I was telling you a little bit earlier that I work with a lot of people with OCD. And one of the things I've been thinking a lot about in my practice lately is how, you know, just us in the eating disorder community, I feel like we don't talk about exposures as much in terms of eating disorders and food and weight. And, you know, you hear about CBTE, and you also hear about family-based treatment. Mm-hmm. You might hear about DBT, you know, intuitive eating. And for those who don't know, those are a lot of the really popular treatments for eating disorders. But you really don't hear exposures being talked about as much. And me, so I'm also so involved in the OCD community, and that's all we do is talk about exposures and exposure therapy. Again, for the listeners, exposure therapy is like the gold standard treatment for OCD. So, you know, as I've been working in my practice with the both populations, people with OCD and people with exposures, people with OCD and people with eating disorders, I started seeing that I was constantly doing exposures with my clients with eating disorders. And it kind of, it works the same way that it does for people with OCD. So I'll just give you an example. When I'm working with someone with OCD, say someone has a phobia or fear of a bridge. So for some reason, say they went over this bridge, or they saw a movie at some point, or they somehow got a message that this bridge is dangerous. And from then on, they started avoiding the bridge. So every time they avoid the bridge, that behavior is strengthening the fear in their brain towards bridges. And so what I would explain to this person, and if they're coming in for a phobia or OCD, some type of anxiety treatment, I would explain to them that in order to be able to manage this fear, because we might not be able to completely get it away. I'm always more of a manage, sort of, we'll see what happens. I think the approach of we're going to get rid of your anxiety doesn't work. So I'll say, you know, we have to gradually expose you to the bridge. So maybe we'll look at pictures, we'll go sit by it, and, you know, we'll gradually go over it. And eventually, if you go over the bridge over and over, your brain starts to learn that it's safe and it's actually not that dangerous, right? So, you know, working with people with eating disorders, what I'm sure you see too, you usually have most of the time I usually have dietitians involved that are helping clients with meals and a meal plan. And so I'm helping support them. And as I'm watching them, I'm like, we're just doing exposures. Like, we're, you know, as they add certain foods to the meal plan or take away things, or it's what we're doing is we're showing that person that the more they eat this certain food, or they meet certain energy needs, they aren't, like, nothing bad's going to happen. And that kind of shows their brain that they're safe and they're okay. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense so far?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I think all of the avoidance of certain foods, right? All of like the ritual behaviors that we were talking about earlier in the session, like body checking, all of that stuff, what that does is teaches the brain that I need to do those things to stay safe. Right. And so if you gradually don't do those things anymore, it's obviously going to cause the person quite a bit of anxiety. Like the first time they eat a food that they haven't had in a long time, mm-hmm. or they don't do a behavior that they normally do to relieve their anxiety, they're doing it as an exposure. Like, I'm not going to do that this time. You know, it's definitely going to cause a lot of anxiety, but the more they do it and the more consistent they are, mm-hmm. You know, it starts to rewire the brain, and the brain no longer sees those things as threats. It starts to see, you know, food as food, something nourishing, something safe. It doesn't have these, you know, that's dangerous, that's unhealthy, that's scary. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious your thoughts on all of that.
Totally. I mean, just having gone through my own treatment, I totally remember all of this. It was like, yeah, scary to think about, oh my gosh, like I've had this belief, like it was a rule, like it was just gospel, like those are not okay to eat, those whatever was on my list. And it was like the scariest thing, like what's going to happen? Like the bad thing, right? Like if I, someone with OCD, like if I don't check the lock 13 times, like yes. The bad thing's going to happen, right? I have to do it. Like if I eat that, you know, or if I don't exercise X amount of minutes, because it was like to the minute, like if it was 3 minutes under, it's like it didn't count or something, right? Yeah. Like if I went on vacation, God forbid, you know, and I didn't get to do it, like I didn't know what was going to happen. But in my mind, it was like a catastrophe, right? Like my anxiety was through the roof. My day was ruined, or, you know, like skip sleep to make sure I got that in, like whatever. Above and beyond anything, because the head would spin with, you know.
Yeah.
The anxiety was crazy. It's like not doing it is like tolerating, you know, there's some DBT in there. Like,
yeah.
It's like the tolerating of the distress of not doing it and realizing I'm going to be okay. The world's not going to end. Mm-hmm. The bad thing's not going to happen.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point. It's really all comes down to whether it's OCD exposures, eating disorder exposures, kind of tolerating that discomfort of, you know, of the anxiety or what could go wrong, or, you know, is this really bad thing going to happen if I eat it? I think there's just so much in both cases, like avoidance of emotions and not wanting to tolerate the discomfort. Mm-hmm. But when you do gradually learn to tolerate it, you see that, one, you kind of get your life back, and, you know, you can start doing things that you never thought you could do. Mm-hmm. And you just, I think you get a lot more confidence in your ability to cope as well.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting because I'll work with people, right? Like to your point, who have fears of bridges or something, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. And they could just very, you know, pull out articles like, look, this bridge collapsed or this or this or this. You can't convince me that it isn't going to happen. It's like, well, okay. I mean, 100%. You could fixate on anything and convince me this catastrophic thing will happen, right? Just like with an eating disorder thoughts are just, I mean, Ed's really strong. Be like, if I eat that, you know it's going to happen. And that's the fear I find with most people. I don't know what you find. It's like, I'm so afraid to go into treatment and change something because their catastrophic thing is their body's going to shift and change, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, again, going back to what I was saying earlier about their goals coming into treatment. So I feel like I always try to go back to that, because there is, to your point, there is such a strong core fear of, you know, what if my body does change? What if I lose control around food? And it does feel, you know, like a catastrophic end of the world thing for those people. And I feel like you can't really combat that with logic, in my opinion. I just, I think I was also going to say earlier that with all of these exposures, I think the brain pays a lot more attention to our behaviors than what we say to ourselves. So if someone's saying to themselves, bridges are safe, I always tell people that doesn't work. Like, you could read all these articles and tell yourself that they're safe, and you can, you know, same thing with eating disorders. Like, you could tell yourself, like, you know, that food's safe and I'm going to be okay. But the brain kind of pays more attention to our behaviors. So again, this is kind of how I see it, that it pays attention to more what we're doing. So you could tell it, like, it's okay to eat these foods. It's okay if I skip, exercising. It's okay. My therapist says fine, you know, but your brain also just, it's like, well, for the past 4 years, you avoided this. So you've created such a strong fear pathway there that really the way through that is kind of gradually showing yourself that I could do those things and still be fine. And then you'll have a different fear response. But I think that's a really important point for people to understand, because I feel like people, you know, they'll try a new food or like a fear food or a restaurant or, some of their therapists or dietitians' recommendations. And then they're kind of basing it off of like, they're basing their opinion off of the first few times they do it. Like, they'll be like, well, that was terrible. And like, this is never going to work. And I was still so scared. And like, this is never going to get better. So I feel like that explanation of, in how this happened to your brain, right? Like, why all that psychoeducation, like why your brain's doing this, why there's a fear association with those foods or with not doing certain behaviors, and how the rewiring of your brain's not going to help happen overnight. And also there could be some malnourishment piece too. So it's like a whole complex piece, and we have to pace ourselves, and it's not going to be this overnight process. I don't know if you see that, if you saw that with yourself or with people that you work with, like kind of expecting, like, I could just tell myself, like, you know, this food isn't scary, and just kind of expecting it to, you know, like click and make the anxiety go away.
Yeah, I totally see that. And I think you brought up such a good point too. If someone's brain's malnourished, the ability to think rationally is not there. And so the more someone like gets refed and their brain's more nourished, the ability to think more clearly definitely comes with time. And so it's much easier, first of all, to have more balanced emotions and think more clearly. And I think it just, things get more easy as well. So I don't know, you know, if you see that too, but I mean, I see big shifts in people over time when they are eating more foods, more variety of foods, their life's fuller, they are not engaging in so many of the eating disorder behaviors, they're spending more time on other things, their mind's less occupied and full of eating disorder thoughts. The shifts happen slowly over time. It's not like this one big light bulb day, but it's like they look back and go, whoa, something's different.
Yeah. I think malnourishment and refeeding and being nourished and eating adequately, like that's a huge part of recovery. Definitely in my practice, I'm always, you know, making my clients aware that that's kind of a big piece of it. And just how important it is and how much alone that can help, right? Like, I mean, DBT is great. CBT is great. Doing food exposures are great. I guess during refeeding, you're kind of doing food exposures. But, you know, the point I was trying to make was that, you know, the re-nourishing your body can do so much for our brains, like sans all these other fancy treatments.
Yeah, because you're like, to your point, you're a biological being first and foremost, you know, like, I don't know how you feel about it, but I always kind of like look at the biology first. It's like, if you're not sleeping well, if you're not getting enough water, if you're not like, getting enough nutrition, like everything else is kind of hard to implement, right? Like, I don't know how I can do CBT with somebody if they're not getting enough sleep, if they're malnourished, you know, like therapy is hard to do and it's hard to process all this stuff when like you're offline.
Right. Definitely.
So I guess start there. I mean, to your point, like the mammalian brain takes over and it's like, it wants you to focus on thinking about food because that's the one thing it needs. I mean, that's how we stay alive and function.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. You brought up in the very beginning of this podcast the things about the certain traits of people. So would you say like there's also the certain traits of people you see who have anxiety and OCD as well as eating disorders? Like, did they share those traits?
Yeah, I think one of the ones I mentioned earlier was the perfectionism. I would say, you know, a lot of black and white thinking, rigidity, sort of. I think there's, how do I say this? Yeah, usually a lot of self-criticism. You know, just like being harsh on themselves, like that sort of, I don't know if you would agree with that or not. Just, you know, a lot of very also moral, like morally strong people or people that want to always like do the right thing. And, you know, I think this is what happens with the eating disorders too, right? People with OCD, I mean, you could have a lot of different OCD themes that are moral related, but I think what happens, they hear all these views from the outside about dieting and food, and they want to do the right thing because that's kind of innate with them. Like they're like, a lot of people that are like very by the book, like they want to just, you know, if the doctor says like, this is the way to be healthy, this is how I'm going to be healthy. Like if I'm supposed to go to school and get good grades, I'm going to go to school and get good grades. Like, if you shouldn't eat this, I'm not going to eat this. So, you know, just people that want to live their life in a way that they feel is effective, right? Yeah. And so I think they get kind of deterred by all this noise out there and misinformation about, you know, how to be healthy. They think they're just like following, you know, what they think is the way to be healthy. And then years later, you know, it develops into an eating disorder. And then, you know, in treatment, they find out that a lot of that stuff isn't healthy at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. So you're obviously in practice. And so is there a place where people can find you, can get information? Is there certain areas where you work in terms of like states or like, are you kind of open to everybody?
Yeah. So I have a group practice. There's actually three of us. It's called Clear Light Therapy. We're in New Jersey. They can find me at Clear Light Therapy NJ on Instagram. And then my website is my name. So Dana Coulthart. I'm sure you'll put in one of the links, my last name. I'm not going to confuse people with the spelling. Yeah, so I actually am licensed in about six states now, I think. Nice. It's all listed on my website. But yeah, so that's where people can find me.
Excellent. Okay. All right. Was there anything you want to leave people with in terms of a message or something to think about before we end?
Yeah, I think, you know, I would really encourage people to think about if they are struggling with eating or food, how those fears developed and if they can do some small exposures, whether they're working with a dietitian or a therapist, maybe they can bring it up to one of them or they want to challenge their own food rules and kind of look at it as, you know, I'm going to do a little exposure and I'm going to try this food, even though it's scary, and I'm going to try it every day and see how I feel at the end of the week. Yeah. So I would just really encourage them to kind of look into the exposure route a little bit more in their recovery and see if they can talk to someone about it, see if someone can help them along that path, because it really can help people a lot once they start conceptualizing why these fears developed and how they can chip away at them.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. This is, you know, something I think we talked about before getting on here, like people don't talk about very much. So I really, really appreciate all the work you're doing and for coming on and sharing all this.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.